Welcome to the Whose Body Is It podcast. I'm your host, Isabella Malbin. For those who don't know me, I'm a birth worker, a life coach, hypnotist, and a former liberal feminist turned radical truth teller. On this podcast, I expose the forces at play attempting to control our minds and bodies, such as transgender ideology, pornography, prostitution, and so much more. Together, we'll untangle patriarchal lies as you listen to jaw-dropping interviews with women from around the world. Warning, while listening to this podcast, you might find yourself triggered or perhaps notice where you've been biting your tongue on the issues that matter most to you. In my coaching and hypnosis, I help women and men stop getting triggered by every single thing, cultivate resilience, stop unwanted behaviors, and increase self-confidence. You can book your first session at whosebodyisit.com, and you can find that link in the episode show notes. And I just want to say that it's because of your endless support that I'm able to interview amazing women, get their stories out, and produce regular episodes for you. So with that being said, please like, comment, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. And if you're listening in, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And also consider making a financial contribution via the link in my show notes. You can also visit my activist sticker shop. My pro-woman stickers have the power to intercept transhumanist programming. So take a photo of your stickers out in the wild and tag me on Instagram at Whose Body Is It. Without further ado, let's get into this week's story. Deborah, a former bio queen, aka a female impersonator, saw firsthand the hierarchy of the LGBT community where men retain their male privilege even after medicalization. The hierarchy, according to Deborah, places, quote, trans women and gay men at the top with bio queens, drag kings, and trans-identified females on the bottom. Deborah's friends in the drag community amplified her dissatisfaction with being female and told her that all of her problems would be solved if she took testosterone. Every problem from low energy to bipolar disorder would be cured with a little T. But at the age of 31, testosterone stole Deborah's singing voice, destroyed her energy, and made her more anxious and mentally unstable than ever before. Amidst all the swirling degeneracy of queer culture, Deborah was drawn to the law and order of Judaism. She began studying and eventually converted. With this newfound appreciation for life in the here and now, buying into trans ideology just wasn't cutting it. In this episode, we explore the nuance of faith and cult beliefs and dive into the woman-erasing theology at the heart of the queer cult. Deborah, where do your identity conflicts begin?
Gosh, that's a great question. I would say I kind of always struggled with identity stuff. I was raised non-religious by a very liberal father and sort of a centrist mother, both lapsed Catholics in the suburbs of Chicago. And I grew up in a very red district. And because I was raised by these sort of like liberal kind of people, I didn't feel like I fit in at all. Almost everybody that I knew in my school was some kind of Christian, except for the small group of Jewish kids and Hindu kids who I kind of ended up relegated with. I felt some solidarity with them because they were the minority. And in a super conservative Christian town, like the one that I grew up in, I always felt like I didn't belong. And, I remember in high school, it was during, I think, George W. Bush's second race for president, you know, I was the only one who was like, not only one, but I was one of the few people who were like, wow, oh, John Kerry, let's get him in office. And everybody around me had like W bumper stickers. And so I was like this lone atheist or agnostic Democrat in a sea of Christian conservative Republican kids. And so that in and of itself was kind of destabilizing, because it was like, I feel like I didn't have a lot of people to talk about my struggles with. Especially because I was excluded from things for like not being Christian. And that was really weird, because I was like, sometimes I feel like I understand Christianity better than you guys, because you're bullying me and excluding me and making me feel bad. I feel like Jesus wouldn't be cool with that, you know, but because I hadn't accepted Jesus into my heart, you know, they considered me like doing like witchcraft instinct and stuff like that. And then I went from one frying pan into the other. I went to a liberal arts college in upstate New York, pretty tiny, mostly women, because it was historically a women's college. I won't say which one, but you might be able to figure it out if you dig around enough. But when I got there, it was like 60% women, I think, or maybe even 70% women. And then a lot of the men there were gay, because it's one of those places where it attracts more gender nonconforming men than straight guys. So like the pool of straight men was really small. And this college, when I got into it, I remember going to the Princeton Review at Barnes and Noble and like flipping through and looking up the college, and it said, oh, this college is well known for having extremely beautiful women. And I was like, great. Cause by then, coming of age during the time of Britney Spears and Paris Hilton and Tara Reid and low-rise jeans, that in and of itself was a very destabilizing force, because I didn't fit into that mold at all. I was actually just talking to my mom yesterday that low-rise jeans like made me build this complex where I couldn't even bend over to pick things up for a long time, because I was so nervous about my butt crack hanging out, because boys used to stick their finger or their thumb in my butt crack because it was hanging out, and I didn't feel comfortable in thongs. And that was the only way you could kind of cover it. And something that I also remember very distinctly of when I was like, oh, hold on a second. In terms of gender ideologies, I was talking to a friend that I had at the time, a trans identifying male. I actually like helped nurse him through facial feminization surgery and all this stuff. So I've seen the really like disturbing side of the medicalization of transgender people. But I remember him saying something to me about like, oh, you didn't like low rise jeans. I thought it'd be so cool to like, you know, see these hot teenage girls and, you know, almost being able to see their vaginas and things like that. And I was like, this is how I know that you can never truly be a woman, because if you aren't even thinking about the fact that as an adolescent, you're so uncomfortable in your female body and you're so comparing yourself to other women, like as a bisexual, I was not even thinking for a second, like, oh, cool, I get to ogle these hot ladies. It was more like, do I want to be this girl or do I want to be with this girl? Again, a very conservative Christian town and the, you know, era of George W. Bush pre-gay marriage. I totally crushed that stuff down. I was like, I'm just a straight girl. I don't need to deal with all, you know, my attraction to women at all. All women feel that way, right, guys? And so it took a long time to radically accept my identity. And even today, like, I feel like it's only just now at 35, I've finally accepted my bisexuality. I finally accepted my femaleness and how it's intrinsically tied to the body, and that sex, it matters. It might be the only thing that matters at this point, especially with the, you know, climate right now. I used to be very like, oh, I don't want to come off too turfy. You know, I don't want to come off transphobic to anybody. So I'll just tamper my voice and not be critical, because I don't want to hurt people's feelings. But now it's like, I'm like, can you guys stop making me agree with Ben Shapiro that like facts don't care about your feelings? You know, because that guy really annoys me. But he makes a lot of sense when it comes to the transgender stuff. Sure. So, yeah.
So one thing that you mentioned that was unusual about your story, that as you've said it, I'm like, oh yeah, that is kind of unusual, is the age that you started identifying as a man Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I was always uncomfortable in my body, and I would say probably fell more under body dysmorphia. I struggled with bulimia for a really long time. And when I was about 30, I started off in kind of the burlesque scene because I was like, I saw these other women talk about how much burlesque helped me accept their bodies and feel comfortable in it. And I was like, well, I'll give that a go. I've always been a performative, theatrical person. Due to sexual traumas that I experienced in college, I was an English theater double major and I dropped the theater major and like quit acting because I just didn't know how to deal with the trauma. And I wasn't getting cast in things. So I was like, forget about it. I don't need to be a theater major. But that bug of performing like never went away. I tried stand-up comedy, I tried improv, storytelling, and then burlesque then led me into the drag scene. And I started seeing a handful of women who would be drag queens. And they were called bio queens at the time, although now that's been outlawed by the gender cultists, because then it recognizes biology and it recognizes that these are women being drag queens. And so I kind of like became this hybridized burlesque drag performer, and I ended up getting a lot more gigs in the drag scene. And that's what really kind of pushed me. Within like 2 years, I was identifying as non-binary and having a lot of friends tell me like, you should transition, you can just microdose tea, it's no big deal. Pretty crazy things. And because I didn't want to lose my place in this community that I'd grown to love so much, I figured my voice had more weight or importance if I talked about the issues of sexism within the drag scene. People would take me more seriously if I identified as trans or non-binary or both or whatever, because then you can be like, well, as a trans masculine person, the way that you guys talk about the female body is really messed up. And I realized after about 5 years, I quit drag very recently and was like, this has actually just been like a very public display of mental health issues and dealing with that stuff in performative ways, and thinking of my womanhood as a costume that I can take on and off ended up being damaging for me. You mentioned that you're a patrilineal Jew, so I'm sure you're familiar with the story of the golem. But for those people who aren't, the golem was a man created out of dust and clay in the earth, used to protect Jews in the Middle Ages who were about to face a pogrom. And he ended up, saving the Jews, but then he ended up being a destructive force within the Jewish community that built him, and they had to kill him to save themselves. And it's so heart-wrenching because you feel so bad for the golem because he was built to protect, and then he ended up destroying. And that's kind of how I think of my like burlesque drag persona now, because once I started doing burlesque and then drag, my eating disorder virtually disappeared overnight. But then I did have clinically diagnosed gender dysphoria. I was living in California at the time, and I went to Kaiser Permanente, and they gave me a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, even though I'd never exhibited any kind of gender dysphoria as a child. There were certain times where I like cut my own hair off, and I was always trying to figure out sort of a gender neutral nom de plume or something. Because when I was a kid, I really wanted to be a writer, and I really looked up to J.K. Rowling of all people. So it's funny because Harry Potter was such a big part of my childhood, and now you can't even say J.K. Rowling in certain spaces without, get out of here, turf.
I have so many questions. So, first of all, it's kind of unusual to be a woman impersonating a man in a drag space, correct? Like, it's not the
Very
norm. When we think
unusual.
of drag queen, we think of adult men impersonating women. So, when you were performing in this way, what was the context? I mean, were you at nightclubs? Were you doing drag queen brunches? Like, what was the context in which you were performing? Was this full time for you?
It was certainly when I was in California, definitely bordering on full time. I had a day job, but that was a part-time day job. But I was making the reason I switched from burlesque to drag is because there was a lot more money to be made. And there's almost like this hierarchy in the drag community of like gay men are at the top in terms of, you know, how much they're making. Trans women are sort of right in there with them, but they are treated differently. I'm not going to lie and say that, like, you know, trans identified males in the drag space don't deal with their own certain kinds of struggles because they're surrounded by these men who are ostensibly doing the same exact things that they are, but they're in, you know, they're determined to be like, no, I'm a woman. But when you're a female in these spaces, you're at the bottom of the pyramid. You're at the bottom of the hierarchy. And it's like blasphemous to even say that, well, trans women get more opportunities than I do. They get paid more than I do. What else do you call that besides male privilege? But to even insinuate that a trans-identified male would continue having male privilege regardless of how far they transition is blasphemous. You know, you can't say that, but I would see it all the time, you know, and I was usually the token female, and sometimes there'd be drag kings. Drag kings are at the bottom of the pyramid of the hierarchy, you know, it would be like gay men and trans women. So males, female drag queens, and then like drag kings at the bottom.
So before you like started taking testosterone, you were considered a drag king?
I was considered a bio queen. You know,
you were considered a bio queen, and then It's so confused. There are so many inversions. I'm like trying to keep track. Okay, so you were considered a bio queen, and then you're feeling the pressure to like take testosterone. You're seeing how you're going to get like more gigs, more attention if you call yourself non-binary, and what was the point where you're like, yeah, I think I'm going to take this to the next level and like inject myself with testosterone?
Let's see, it was the summer of 2021 when I started, because I could no longer afford to live in California, so I moved to a different state, a deep red state, and that also pulled me out of the like delusion of people who live in Los Angeles. like no offense to LA, but like a lot of, especially like queer scene kinds of people in Los Angeles, they are so detached from the reality of your average American. Mm. And so being in a deep red state kind of snapped me out of that La La Land delusion of it all, and being like, oh, like these are people who actually live more in the real world than like, you know, this fantasy land that is Hollywood. And yeah, and the whole bio queen stuff is super confusing. Trying to even explain it, I'm like, yeah, I can see how it would turn somebody for a loop, because it's, you're like a female impersonator. If that makes
female
sense.
Female impersonator.
Yeah. And you know, my desire to do it, it's because I always felt a lot more comfortable in gay spaces with gay men. You know, some of my closest friends are gay men, because due to my traumas and my, you know, difficulty forming relationships, I never felt, you know, the underlying male threat. But at the same time, I also experienced a lot of like open sexism from gay men in the drag community, because, you know, at its heart, drag as what it is now is like a deeply sexist art form. And I'm somebody who believes that you can hold two things to be true at the same time. Is drag a really great outlet for gender nonconforming men to explore the femininity that was denied to them as children? Yes. And I think that's helpful to an extent. Is it also a deeply sexist art form that excludes women and then makes fun of them and mocks their bodies and their experiences? Yes, absolutely. So both of those things can be true at the same time. And because I would see so much, how much joy it brought my gay male friends, I wanted to get in on that as well. You know, RuPaul's Drag Race is something that I used to really love watching, even though some of the language would really bother me. Like, I really can't stand the term fish, or like calling somebody fishy. I think that is just like so deeply wrong and sexist and disturbing to kind of think of women that way. And that's when I sort of really started pushing back on that stuff. I felt like Okay, if I'm a non-binary trans masculine person, it'll be easier for me to say like, hey, this is the way you talk about female bodies. You should think about that more because it hurts my feelings when you're calling men fishy. Like that's really, and I've struggled a lot with the pressures that have been put on me since childhood about how a female body should be, how it should smell, how it should present itself. And to have a bunch of you guys like make fun of it really kind of makes me feel bad about myself, which should have been, it should have been like a light bulb moment of like, I shouldn't be doing this to begin with. This is harming my own psyche. But because I fell really deep into gender ideology, then it started being like, okay, well, if I want to talk the talk, I got to walk the walk as well. So it's almost like I had people convince me, and then I convinced myself that transition would be good for me, especially because I was still dealing with a lot of mental health problems.
Right.
And they seem to not be going away anytime soon.
And I'd like to ask this question for women who have been like in and out of the medicalization. You know, could you just briefly describe your relationship to like medication? You know, you mentioned mental health stuff. Like, was allopathic medication, Western meds, like already a part of your life? Okay.
Yeah.
So then just adding another is like, you know, okay.
Yeah. I've been on all sorts of different psychiatric medications, SSRIs, MAOIs, mood stabilizers. I've been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, of course, bulimia, and bipolar disorder. And I decided actually to try ketamine infusion therapy because I had treatment resistant manic depression. And that has been really wonderful for me. It really pulled me out of feeling constant suicidal ideation. For a brief amount of time, I thought, oh, maybe I don't need to be on any psychiatric drugs at all. But I had a really bad manic episode that it was crazy. I'd never experienced a manic episode like that. So I realized like I should probably be back on a mood stabilizer. So I went back on Lamictal, which has been pretty good at keeping me even keel. But, you know, I was also, what's crazy is that I have been on a form of, up until recently, a form of birth control since I was 19.
Wow. And
yeah, because I used to get really heavy periods and I would have so much cramping and pain that it would trigger my vagus nerve and I would pass out. And so from 19 to 35, I was either on the pill or I had an IUD.
Wow.
And they let me take testosterone while still having an IUD implanted, which I feel like there's very little data on the efficacy of transitioning medically to begin with. In fact, now a lot of the research that I come upon, or I follow this YouTuber, she's also on Substack and Rumble because she keeps getting her channel nuked, but Exalanzic. If you've heard of her, she's like a speech language pathologist, also a detransitioner. And she brings a lot of the stuff to the table of like why estrogen in male bodies is bad for the brain. It's bad for the body. And same thing with testosterone. I mean, it changes the size of your brain, and we have no ethical double-blind studies to show that medical transition is the best way to treat gender dysphoria. Because now that I'm on the other side of things, I don't have gender dysphoria anymore, you know? And it was almost like I got that rapid onset gender dysphoria that we talk about in adolescent girls, but I experienced that at like 30 or 31. And I think I was more vulnerable to that ideology, much like the last person that you interviewed, Emma, because of the sexual traumas, the unstable sense of identity, the body dysmorphia, and kind of just falling into a group where it's like Puritanism. You can't criticize it. You can't be critical of what's being sold without being labeled a TERF and a transphobe. And then you got to go out in the public square and either self-flagellate and, you know, once again, dedicate yourself to gender Jesus, you know, or you just leave altogether. And for me, I was like, I can't have one foot in gender ideology and one foot in material reality and live this way. I stopped the testosterone because I was losing my ability to sing, which is something that's so precious to me. And they told me, the doctors, they were like, well, yes, of course, your voice is going to change. But if you practice and work through it, you shouldn't lose too much of your singing voice. It shouldn't change that much. And I picked up my banjo and I went to go sing a song, and I couldn't even, nothing came out. And I had a panic attack. I started sobbing because it feels like singing is one of the few gifts that I was given just naturally. And I was like destroying it for what? For the sake of an ideology? Like, that's crazy. So I pulled out of it. I didn't consider myself a detransitioner for probably another like almost a year until I started being like, no, actually, I'm not even going to call myself gender fluid, because that's sort of where I landed on. I was like, well, I failed at transitioning, but I still have weird gender feelings, and I don't want to leave this community because I have so much, you know, so many friends and support. But then once you actually label yourself as a detransitioner, that support completely disappears. I've had to tell friends like, hey, I don't really believe in this stuff anymore. And they're like, well, you know, be careful, because that's going into TERF rhetoric. You don't want to say TERF rhetoric. And then I was like, fine, then I am a TERF. If you can't deal with that, if you can't be my friend because I'm saying that biological sex is real and that it's immutable, then if you don't want to be my friend anymore, I understand that, because I can't be friends with somebody who's not going to respect my experiences. I had somebody tell me like, oh, well, don't you think you're just projecting your, you know, failed transition on everybody else and how unfair that is? And I was like, of course I'm projecting, but that's because my experience is almost identical to like so many other people and so many other detransitioners who are coming out of this. So why wouldn't I project my experience on stuff that I'm seeing with my own two eyes, you know?
And it's such a weird thing to say, to accuse you of, because your transition failed. There is no transition. No one's transition is successful, because there's no such thing as transition. Yeah. There's no destination. One cannot go from male to female or female to male. Now the mimicry and the duration of the drug or the surgery, yeah, that is variable, certainly. But but to say, you know, to try to hold that against you because your transition failed, I mean, what an idiotic thing to say, you know? Yeah. You know, if you remember in Emma's episode, in the episode I did with Emma too, she talked about going to support groups, you know, thinking that she was going to be able to ask material questions like, hey, did testosterone do this to your body? And there was absolutely none of it. It was just all ideological, like, you know, banter.
Yeah. Well, and we talked about this earlier before we started, but I also, because of my unstable sense of identity, and because I'm somebody who I know I need rules and boundaries, and I wasn't raised in any sort of religious faith. I did always have an interest in Judaism because a lot of my friends are Jewish. I have Jewish cousins, so I would celebrate Hanukkah with them sometimes. I had friends that I celebrated Hanukkah with. I always kind of felt this calling, like I desired to have a religious or spiritual expression because I was denied that as a child. My parents were kind of like, oh, let the kids choose if they want to go to church or not. And it's like, well, I'm telling you right now, a 7-year-old girl is not going to want to wake up early and go sit at Catholic Mass. And because that is boring as hell.
Yes, agree. As someone who was forced to do that, I agree. Yes.
So, but I always felt like I had a connection to Judaism somehow. And so I started looking into the conversion process. And I think in really accepting Judaism and trying to live by the laws that I think are, relevant in the modern era, it really pushed me to accept material reality and kind of pull myself out of the gender ideology. And my way into Judaism was through the Reform Movement. And the Reform Movement is way more accepting and willing to listen to the kind of gender ideology stuff. But the more I looked into conservative Judaism, because my synagogue was Reform and conservative, because there were so few Jews in the place that I was living at the time, I started going to the conservative services. And the conservative services are almost all in Hebrew. So I've gotten really good at Hebrew now. I'm not fluent or anything, but I'm definitely, I would say, I have friends who were raised reform, and I'll talk about something and they're like, I don't know what that means.
So you really dove in. You really dove
Yeah,
in.
I really dove in and I realized how much gender ideology is, it shares a lot of the same stuff as like Christian replacement theology, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but back in, I want to say circa maybe like 70 to 90, I can't remember, but whenever Paul the Apostle was alive and writing, the dates are escaping me right now, but Paul the Apostle basically was like, okay, we can't get all these Jews to convert. They refuse to convert. They refuse to give up, you know, they're like barbaric, whatever. So now we just need to work on replacing the Hebrew Bible with the New Testament. And we're going to replace it through the transubstantiation of the soul, of if it's all based on your soul and something, and you can't prove that a soul exists. I believe in souls. I believe that my, you know, it's fun for me to think about the idea. It's comforting to think about the idea of, as a convert, because I wasn't born into it, that my soul was at Sinai when Moshe handed down the Ten Commandments to Israel. You know, that it makes me feel better to think that my soul was at Sinai. But that doesn't mean that it's true or provable or something that anybody else should accept. If somebody hears that and think that's a lot of crazy nonsense, you know, that's mishigas, as we like to say, I would be totally fine with that. I'm not here to try to get anybody to accept that my soul was at Sinai, because it's ridiculous. But with Christian replacement theology, it's like, forget about all your old laws. Forget about those rules. Who gives a crap about, you know, the Old Testament? That was just the framework. Now we're replacing it with the real stuff. And for me, that I feel like I call gender ideology now woman replacement theology, because it's about abolishing sex and abolishing women altogether. I would see jokes that trans people would make on the internet a lot that really disturbed me. There was one that was like, I can't wait to be the first trans woman to have an abortion. And I'm like, how dare you even joke about that? Like, that's disturbing. Or, oh, you know, it's 100 years from now and all women have dicks. And it's like, like, please, I know you're kidding. I know you're making a joke. But I also know that the theology, the religion that you've dedicated your life to of transness, that's what it calls for. If you follow if you follow the logic to its conclusion, doesn't mean that all trans identifying people believe this, but if you take the theology of trans ideology to its logical conclusion, it is the complete abolition of the female. And that's why I, you know, make that connection between Christian replacement theology and gender ideology, because it's all about replacing this new belief on something that's existed for, you know, the beginning of time. You know, sex predates everything, much in the way that Judaism predates religion. To be Jewish isn't necessarily a state, it's to be from the kingdom of Judah. And so I've naturalized myself as a citizen of the Jewish nation through very rigorous and lengthy conversion practices. And so that was something that I could complete. That's something that I could do in the material world. I can become a Jew by dedicating my beliefs to Jewish law and to Torah. And I did it in a way that the Jewish nation would then accept me as somebody that has equal status. I am allowed to be called up to the Bima for an Aliyah, to chant from Torah and to do all those things, because I did all the necessary steps to prove myself as somebody who will be Jewish for the rest of my life. Now, on the other hand, with transition, no matter how much cosmetic surgery you do, no matter how many hormones you take, you can never actually change your sex. You just can't. So when it came time, when I started realizing, oof, I brought something akin to Christian replacement theology into a synagogue, it made me feel really nauseous almost, because I don't want to be somebody who's advocating for the changing of holy scripture, holy word, Lashon HaKodesh, that's been around for thousands and thousands of years. I feel like it's destructive to, a really ancient religion or really ancient spiritual practice, because it's not just a religion, it's an ethno-religion. And right. That was something that I experienced, by the way, once I started studying to be Jewish, once I started self-identifying out into the Gentile world, because I wouldn't go into a synagogue halfway through my conversion and be like, I'm a Jew, let me up on the Bima. No. But when talking to people outside of the synagogue, outside of the Jewish community, it got to a point where, you know, I was wearing a kippah, I was wearing my Magen David, and people just naturally assumed, okay, she must be Jewish. And I was treated differently on the ethnic basis of Judaism. All the anti-Semitism that I've experienced, 99% of it revolves around, you don't look Jewish. Somebody said he needed to measure my nose. People all of a sudden thought that I was good with money, and it was all, it was all this sort of racial stuff.
Right.
So it even changed my perception of my own ethnic identity, because I was now experiencing this racial form of bigotry. And I think that's where trans identified people, they get caught up in, if you look like a woman and you start experiencing misogyny, oh, it's almost like they're happy about it. Like they're happy to experience sexism because that means they're a real woman. But,
right.
But then once the reality of sex plays into it, that's where you get the hysteria of, oh, if you're straight, you have to find trans women attractive because you're mm-hmm. straight and we're women. And it's like, come on. You know, that's almost right. like conversion therapy to me.
Right.
To,
and know. there's no like the distinction with, like, I think what you're saying, you know, you're not a Jew impersonating. You're not claiming to be the race of Jew, right? You
yes.
have taken on the spiritual practice, the religious practice that goes mm-hmm. along with Judaism, and through your synagogue have completed the steps to be recognized in that context as a Jew, right? And so there's transparency at all levels around who you are.
Yeah. And at this, and also further, I would never be so bold as to claim, like, oh, I've actually been Jewish this whole time. I just was stuck in a Gentile body and I've actually really just right. been Jewish this whole time. And I was Jewish when I was a little kid. I just didn't know it. Like that's offensive to me. I was not a Jew. I felt kinship with Jews, probably because I was excluded a lot in school and ended up with the Jewish kids. And Judaism always kind of made sense to me, but I wouldn't be so bold as to claim, like, I've been Jewish this whole time. That would be ridiculous, because I haven't. I had to go through the conversion process.
Right.
And I find that when I talk to a lot of trans-identified people, or someone like Laverne Cox, for example, stating like, oh, well, I had a girlhood, it just looked different than yours. And it's like, no, you can't possibly know what it's like to experience getting your period in class and everybody making fun of you. Or, you know, the trauma of going through puberty in a female body in a society that so deeply hates women. Like, you just don't know what that's like. If anything, you were probably a gender nonconforming child who, was punished for expressing any kind of femininity as a boy. Mm-hmm. And that can be, of course, that's traumatizing. Of course, that makes you feel bad. Doesn't mean it's one for one the same experiences as a female, as a girl going through girlhood into puberty and becoming a woman. It's right. not the same. You can right. draw parallels. And I think that's why so many women in particular are really susceptible to feeling bad for the suffering and being like, yes, I accept you as a woman. I find that it's women who tend to more be like, oh yeah, trans women are women. And mm-hmm. They're the allies. They're the bigger allies, because I think they see a similarity in the struggle, but it's dangerous to say that they're the same, in my opinion.
What do you think the function, because, you know, this comes up a lot in my interviews with desisted or detransitioned women is they end up finding God or spirituality in some way. And I, you know, I'm also sitting here thinking like, okay, well, also, what would be the harms of conversion, right? You know, like versus the harms of female impersonation, male impersonation, like there aren't really, I mean, not that I can see any real harms in converting from one spiritual practice to another.
Yeah.
Maybe someone would disagree, but yeah, I'm interested to hear you talk about, you know, the function of this framework, as you mentioned before we record, like the rules and the framework. Can you talk a little bit about like the comfort you've found in?
Yeah, of course. When I was a kid, my parents constantly disagreed on how to raise my sister and I. So we didn't really have a lot of boundaries. We didn't have a lot of rules. There wasn't a lot of discipline. And I think that's probably contributed to my unstable sense of identity, because you need to have a unified front when you're a parent with the other parents. You need to be on the same page about how we're going to discipline the kids, what rules we're going to put in place, what chores they have to do. My house was in constant disarray emotionally. So I really was never given structure. And I was really good at school. That's why my autism and ADHD didn't get diagnosed until I was an adult, because school had boundaries and strict schedules. And, you know, I knew where I had to be at a certain time. And I think part of the reason I was drawn to Judaism in particular is because they are so dedicated to laws and rules and depending on which movement you go into, you know, there's, if you're an Orthodox Jew, there's a lot of laws that they follow. You know, the mitzvot, which are the commandments, I think there's 613 of them from Torah. And a lot of them, you actually have to be in Israel to to do. Like a lot of the mitzvot, you have to actually be in Eretz Israel to even complete them. So, you know, that puts a lot of diaspora Jews like, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to do that one because I'm not in Israel. So, you know, that's what's great about Judaism is there's concessions. There are, how do we work with what we have in the here and now? That's why there was splits. There's the reform movement and the conservative movement. And, you know, because I love structure and because I love studying law, like something that I do as like a side hobby is I really love watching the Real Housewives franchises.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah. And so I started delving into the law with regards to the Real Housewives, because I would be fascinated by the cases against someone like Teresa Giudice or Jen Shah, like anybody who's come into legal trouble in the Real Housewives universe.
That is so fascinating.
Yeah, I would read all the court documents because I want to understand what's really going on here. And so something that I tend to turn to, not just with housewives, but in anything legal, I'll be the one that's like, well, let me see the legal documents that are available. So, and then, you know, that kind of lent itself really well to studying Talmud and halakha, which is Jewish law, because I was already primed to find that stuff interesting. There's a reason why so many Jewish people fall into becoming lawyers, because we're studying law already. It's a Jewish law, but I can totally see why somebody who was raised in that faith would then fall into the track of being a lawyer, because they're already well-versed in a law. It's just not laws that Gentiles follow. You know, once I started really getting into following certain mitzvot, I'm kosher, or I try to be kosher. I'm living with my mom right now. She's not kosher. She's a Catholic, so she eats whatever she wants. So it's been a little bit difficult living here, but I try to dedicate myself to certain things, kosher, Shabbat. I try to keep Shabbat. I don't work on Saturdays. And because Judaism really deals with material reality in a way that I would say Christianity and Islam don't, because they're very focused on the next world or heaven. Or, you know, although I'm not as well versed in Islam as I am in Christianity. So if I'm saying anything that's like not lining up with any Muslim listeners. I apologize. and I would say in America, when we think of Islam, we probably think more of like the extremist versions of it. Mm-hmm. But if you follow the logical conclusions of these, like the more extremist or the fringe sects, you know, like 72 virgins in heaven, or you get to be with Jesus in heaven in the next kingdom. That's not something that's present in Judaism. It's much more focused on the here and the now and the material reality of things. That's why I have a problem with some of the things that the Reform movement does. The Reform movement has been really great at keeping Judaism alive and going in, you know, times where people are trying to take that religion away, or, you know, during times of pogroms and mass genocide. Reform has been the way to be like, we're modern Jews. We're Jews that, you know, we're no different from anybody else, you know, and I think that's been really helpful in keeping it alive. But at the same time, if you concede too much, and Reform Judaism does this with trans ideology, if you bring too much of that in, I feel like it's destabilizing for halakha. And so in the Reform movement, they'll point to the six genders of the Talmud for reasons why we should just be like totally cool with all this stuff. Because look, these rabbis in the Middle Ages were already talking about gender nonconformity and androgyny and what do we do about it. And I think it's a little bit misrepresented in the Reform movement, because if you actually read those segments of the Talmud that talk about the different genders and the nonconformity of it, they're not saying, oh, isn't this so great? Isn't this so wonderful that we have these androgynous people? We should really celebrate that. What they're really saying is like, what do we do about these freaks? You know, they're like, what should we do with these lunatics who think that they're stuck in the wrong body or something? Or what should we do about this man who likes to flit around in a dress? You know, what do we do about it? And they came to the conclusion of, well, they're Jews. They have holiness within them because all people are capable of having holiness. But we're not going to change Torah for them. We don't change Torah for anybody, regardless of their feelings. And once I started really accepting that, that's when I was like, I need to fully remove myself from the gender folks. I need to, you know, go back to my turfy ways or whatever, because before I got indoctrinated into it, I had questions that people would nowadays consider like turf rhetoric. Of, you know, when I first heard about non-binary, I was like, what? Right, like, this doesn't make any sense.
But I mean, I'm curious about your experience, like having a, you know, what I would call like a feminist analysis, like how has that been for you now practicing Judaism? Like, is there, do you find that there's space for gender nonconformity? Do you find that there's space for bisexuality? How has that been for you?
Well, being in the conservative movement, they're definitely like much more than the Orthodox movements, although modern Orthodox is getting a little more comfortable with like the idea of homosexuality. Reform and conservative, they're totally cool with like homosexuality, bisexuality, because those are sex-based. It's something you can't change. Like by now we've all realized like you can't change the fact that you're attracted. You're a man attracted to other men. That's not something that's going to go away. So, you know, that's based in material reality. But then once you get into sort of the woo-woo gender stuff, I feel like it's hard to say, because again, I was at a synagogue that was Reform / conservative. So while Reform is really welcoming of trans people and really like, yay, let's celebrate the trans, I'm not quite sure where conservative movement lies. They're a little more traditional. They're not fully Orthodox, but that's where the word conservative comes from. When people hear conservative Jew, they probably think politically, for obvious reasons, but it's actually about conserving tradition, and emphasizing that there are certain traditions that we need to follow to adhere to halakha in a way that's both modern and fits within modern society, but is not giving up. We're not giving anything up just to assimilate. Mm-hmm. But then we're not as far into, you know, in certain Orthodox communities like the Hasidim and the Haredim, they're definitely like hardline, like, no on the homosexuality. It says right there in Leviticus, you know, but that seems to be changing. Like I said, modern Orthodox seems to be moving a little closer to accepting that, like, well, Kind of the science proves it, or not the science at least, but the anecdotal evidence is overwhelmingly in favor of, like, yeah, you can't change that you're gay. You just can't.
Right. Well, you mentioned you're living with your mom now, and I have a couple thoughts as you're sharing. I'm like, well, I guess I'm curious about what made you stop taking testosterone, right? Besides from the ideology, were there any like physical impacts on your body that you just couldn't, you know, deal with anymore? Aside from your voice, that you mentioned losing your voice was like a deal breaker.
Yeah, that was definitely once I couldn't sing, and luckily, thank goodness, I've been able to regain a lot of my range. But once I couldn't sing, that's when I absolutely decided to stop. However, on top of that, it was also making me physically and mentally like really sick, actually. Like the testosterone made me really, really, really tired. I was told by the gender doctors that I would get all this energy and I'd want to like work out and stuff. And I'd have all this expendable energy, which was not the case for me. I was more tired than ever. There were some days I couldn't get out of bed. And then it made me even more delusional, like mentally. Like I had more confidence, but it kind of bordered on almost like, I don't know what else to call it other than delusion, because I felt really like unconquerable. And for somebody like me who already struggles with mental health things and already has a propensity to fall into delusional thinking, that made me really scared. And on top of that, I was crying a lot. Like I was having a lot of mood swings. And I talked to other trans-identifying females before I transitioned to see what their experiences were. I had a friend who also struggles with bipolar disorder, and you know, she was saying like, you know, testosterone didn't do anything to my bipolar disorder. Like I'm actually really stable, and it's really great, and I have all this energy, and blah blah blah. So it was almost like it was being sold to me as like a cure-all for all of my issues. And when you suffer with mental illness, when you're like afflicted almost, that sounds like a really great thing. Like, oh, a medication that's a cure all for all of my problems. Why wouldn't I want to give that a try? And so when I went to the gender clinic, which by the way, I got diagnosed with gender dysphoria while I was in California by Kaiser Permanente. But they would not let me do top surgery unless I went on testosterone first for a year. And I was still really nervous about testosterone. So, and because I'm well endowed in the chest area, I have a lot of back pain. And it also contributed to my body dysmorphia because I felt like it made me look fatter. So top surgery was always something that I was more interested in. And I was like, oh, these transphobes at Kaiser Permanente won't let me get top surgery because I don't want to go on testosterone. When I got to the red state that I lived in, and you know, if you Google this, I'm probably giving it away, but it's a state that is like, I think the number one plastic surgery state in the country. It's a red state, but they're really well known for their plastic surgery, which is kind of wild. But when I went to the gender clinic there, like they were like, yeah, you don't need to go on testosterone to have top surgery. Like we'll sign you up. Like you're ready to go. Like we'll have you see a specialist and you already have the diagnosis of gender dysphoria. So why not? And I was like, oh, score. I don't even have to go on T. But then a lot of my friends would say, well, it's better. Your top surgery will go better if you're on testosterone. Like you should try T. Like you can even microdose it. And I was like, ugh.
Oh my God.
And because I kind of let myself get talked into the idea that like, you know, testosterone's not that bad. Any of the detractors, they're just mean, nasty turfs who want to ruin our fun. Even though in the back of my head, I kind of always had that radical feminist saying like, oh, this is kind of crazy, you know? I started on a very low dose and lower than the, you know, what's given for like binary trans people. I wasn't getting any of the side effects that I was promised other than like more masculinizing, like my face was getting a little more masculine. I was growing some body hair. But again, I was taking it very slowly. So it was very small changes. And now luckily, I mean, I'm very thankful that I was smart enough to do low dose and then I stopped 6 months in, but I felt kind of, you know, duped because I was told testosterone was going to do all these great, amazing things for me. And if anything, it did the exact opposite. And I think part of me also was looking at, you know, my transition as a way to maybe deal with some of the sexism within the trans community, because I was like, yeah, the testosterone gives me a higher libido, but I'm actually crying a lot more than, you know, your average man particularly, but definitely crying a lot more than even your average woman. Like, I was listening to a podcast and they even just mentioned the movie The Last Dinosaur and I burst out into tears.
Oh my gosh. Oh God. Oh no.
So I felt very destabilized, and it was crazy because people would always ask me like, oh, are you hornier now? Are you into sports? Like, or I would see trans identified females like make outlandish claims like, oh, I've been on T for a couple months and I'm really into baseball now. And it's like,
oh my God, so ridiculous.
It really is. You can't help but laugh because it's like, no, like that proves to me beyond a doubt that you're really just playing up gender stereotypes and it's really just cosplay.
Oh my God.
Like, you should have had an interest in baseball. Like, you could have had an interest in baseball before. Like, you, why did you have to go into testosterone to get an interest in baseball?
Oh no, I'm valid now. Oh no. Well, I mean, maybe it was to appeal to some kind of family member or some family tradition that was reserved for the men or whatever. But, you know, what was it like with your family throughout this whole time? And what's it like now? You mentioned you're living with your mom and you're practicing a different faith. I mean.
Well, my family was dubiously supportive when I came out. When I started identifying as non-binary, I'm pretty sure in the back of their heads, they were all like, oh, here's another, like, you know, phase, because I was somebody who always went through different phases. And I was just trying to find that place where I felt comfortable so I could be comfortable with myself. And, you know, finally, luckily I found that through Judaism. But the non-binary stuff, they were like, okay, I had them call me a different name, you know, a more gender neutral name. I was trying to get them to use the correct pronouns. I gave up on that. Like, the pronoun thing I gave up on pretty quickly, because I was like, I'm not going to force people to call me they, them. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, look at me, I'm a woman, you know? And, then when I started talking about testosterone and top surgery, like, they got really scared, but again, they didn't want to tell me that. They were just like, okay, we're supportive. Like, whatever you want to do, if you think that's right. I have an older sister who's a nurse, and I know that she was really like, please don't go on testosterone. Like, that's crazy. And she knew all the risks that go with that, but I didn't want to hear it. And then after I pulled myself out of the cult, I basically apologized to my whole family. I was like, I'm so sorry that I put you through this. I'm sorry that I scared you with the idea of a double mastectomy just to like solve my problems, when that absolutely wasn't going to solve my problems. And when I think about it now, if I'd gone through with it, I probably would have been much more susceptible to suicide after the fact. And transition is always sold as a mitigating medical way to not be suicidal. And I know right now that if I had gotten a double mastectomy and then snapped out of it, I would have been in a mental hospital like immediately. So I'm really thankful that I was able to pull myself out of it and wake up and realize that it's not worth throwing my life away for an ideology. And that's what keeps me, I think, really tempered with making sure I don't go too far into Jewish ideology, because it's not like it doesn't exist. You know, obviously we have the ultra Orthodox communities, you know, the Hasidim in New York, for example, like, they're much more susceptible to being attacked on the street because they are so visibly Jewish. You know, they've got the peyote and the hats and the beards, and you can clock one from a mile away. And, there were times where I would look at Orthodox women and I'd be like, I could kind of like see the appeal in just like being told what to do and just doing it and being happy with that. But because I'm so deeply feminist, I was like, ah, no, I don't want to go too far into that ideology. So I'd make sure that I would stay away from Chabad. Because if the place where I was, there was the Reform Conservative shul that I was going to, and then there was the Chabad on the other side of town. And I was always too scared to go to the Chabad because I was like, if I hang out with the Chabadniks too much, I'm going to fall into that. And I'm really trying to keep myself from from falling too far into any ideology, including Judaism. But reform is too lax with the rules, in my opinion. And I don't mean to insult anybody who's reform, but they're much more focused on social justice. And, a lot of it's in English, not as much of the Hebrew. And to me, that's just, it's a little too unstructured for me. I appreciate the structure of conservative Judaism, and I'm scared of how much structure is in Orthodox Judaism, because right. I think Orthodox is probably something that's even harder to convert into. There's probably a lot more pressure on converts to really uphold the mitzvot. And I know that I'm not somebody who can take that on. According to the Orthodox community, they would not consider me a Jew because I did not have an Orthodox conversion, even though I did go in front of a Beit Din and went in into the mikvah and did all this stuff that by law they would also make me do. But because, I want to be able to read from the Torah, for example, I want to be able to be called up to the Bima and chant Torah, that would exclude me from being able to be Orthodox, because women aren't allowed to read from Torah. Right. I feel like I've found a good middle ground. It's about balance. And I think for me, I need structure to keep myself balanced. And with gender ideology, I mean, that stuff's limitless. It's like postmodern nonsense, where it's just, if you think about something hard enough, it's true. And I came into my introduction into postmodernism was when I was in grad school. I went to grad school in Virginia, and I was like, this is impenetrable academia. It is difficult to understand. Judith Butler, I'm like, what is she?
Oh
even
my gosh. I was also indoctrinated with Judith Butler and at RISD. Yeah. I took a lot of, I took some classes at Brown, but RISD had a strong literature department.
I was in the English department. I was going to get my PhD in cultural studies before I realized academia is not for me. These people are a little too woo-woo. And, my foray into postmodernism, I think, made me more susceptible as well to this gender ideology, because it's totally, if you say things enough, if you use enough big words, if you kind of close your ears to anything that's dealing with materialism, then it's just, I feel like, a slippery slope. Once you get into postmodern theory, it leads to queer theory, it leads to Michel Foucault, who was a pedophile. And the pillars of academia are starting to crumble because of that kind of stuff. Universities now will kowtow to protesters who don't want certain speakers to show up, which I think is just a terrible thing for academia. Universities should be bastions of free speech. And if you don't like that, Jordan Peterson or Ben Shapiro showing up, or even friggin' Nazis like Milo Yiannopoulos or whatever his name is, Milo, that guy, or Ann Coulter, anybody that you find really disturbing, they should still have the right to speak at a university. And if you don't like it, why don't you go and see what they're saying before you start getting the torches out? I worry about what's going on in academia, because, the protesters, it just happened at McGill University, where there was
I saw that.
Somebody was there to talk about gender versus sex, and the protesters got so rowdy that they canceled the speaker altogether, which I just think is terrible. That happens a lot with when it comes to Zionism and issues with Israel on campuses all over the country. Yeah. They'll ban Zionists from speaking, or even somebody who
not even a Zionist, just a Jew, with the title Israeli. I interviewed an Israeli artist and feminist named Shira Richter, and she was supposed to speak at a university in Dallas, Texas. It was like 2017, and they canceled it. They canceled it altogether if she had protesters, just because she called herself an Israeli artist, and she actually wouldn't consider herself necessarily, I don't think, a Zionist at all, but it didn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You can be the most anti-Zionist Jew on the planet. You can be protesting with Jewish Voice for Peace, and it'll still be not good enough credentials for the anti-Zionists who they're, again, it's like they're expecting you to self-flagellate. I see a lot of parallels between, you know, Zionist and radical feminist, the way that people treat them. And it's really not shocking to me that the people that get accused most of being the new Nazis are radical feminists and Zionists, because I don't know, I just find it wildly offensive that people aren't allowed to speak at a university just because you don't agree with them. Right. And I feel like it's bad for democracy. I feel like it's bad for academia. You know, radical feminism and Zionism both are like, if you just say those words, they're so toxic to the discourse. Like, people will automatically assume like, oh, you said Zionism, so you must be like the worst of the worst. You want to drink the blood of Palestinian children. It's like, I can't even come into a conversation if that's what you're going to think. And the same thing with, I almost find it funny at this point that feminists get called Nazis, because I think the group of people that would be most excited about the idea of like a state-sanctioned eugenics program in which mentally ill people willingly sterilize themselves would be Nazis. I feel like Dr. Mengele would love what's
right.
going on.
Right. But it's just inversion after inversion and projection.
Yeah, it's Darvo. Just,
yeah. It's totally Darvo. It's 100% Darvo.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this has been an incredibly fascinating conversation with you, and I appreciate your particular vantage point in this issue. As we wrap up, I want to, first of all, is there anything else we didn't get to that you feel like is important to speak to? And then I have a kind of closing question.
Yeah, I think one other point that I wanted to make was that even though teenagers, children, people in their early 20s seem to be more susceptible to falling into this, I didn't fall into it until my 30s, and I didn't detransition. I didn't start calling myself a detransitioner until quite recently at 35. And so I do feel a little embarrassed sometimes when I see, you know, the detransition stories that get the most spotlight, I guess you could say, tend to be way on the younger side. It makes me feel like, oof, I was in a state of arrested development for quite a long time. But that makes sense, because I experienced a lot of sexual trauma around the age 19 through 21. So it would make sense that I was kind of living in that forever 21 mindset. And it makes sense that I was far more susceptible to falling into this ideology, even as a mature adult, even as somebody whose brain was done developing. So, you know, I just wanted to put out there that, like, it's not just these kids. It's also like any adult can fall into it. When I was going to a gym, when I started testosterone, I was like, oh, I should start working out. I want to build up my pec muscles so that my, you know, top surgery doesn't look ridiculous. And one of the trainers there was like 50 something and had just gotten top surgery like a year and a half ago.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Yeah. So it's not just the kids. Obviously, the kids and teenage girls especially are far more susceptible to falling into this. But any adult, if they have an unstable sense of identity, if they're a butch lesbian who still feels really uncomfortable in their body, if they've got the, you know, stone butch blues, you know, it doesn't really matter your age. And if there's anybody else out there who's listening who feels embarrassed that they fell into this, you know, past the age of, you know, 12, then I would say you're not alone. And anybody at any age can fall into sort of a cultish sort of ideology, the way gender ideology. I mean, I consider it a cult now for sure.
It's such a great point. And yeah, it's not something that I thought much about, other than, you know, more, you know, I guess more thinking of middle-aged men, you know, kind of typical autogynephile.
Boy.
but yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, I think you kind of answered my closing question.
Oh, okay.
too. Thank you so much, Deborah, for reaching out and for so honestly and vulnerably sharing your unique story.
Thank you for having me. I saw, I don't know how it popped up on my Instagram, but I think maybe somebody shared it because I have a Finsta, as they call it, or like an alternative Instagram account where I can follow all the TERFs without feeling like I'm going to get, you know, chased out of town with a pitchfork. And I think somebody had shared the interview that you had with Emma. And I was looking at the description and was just like blown away by how many similarities I saw. And I knew I had to reach out to you immediately because I think I have a story that's worth sharing. So thank you for having me on and giving me the space to talk about this stuff.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or family member who needs to hear this content. And if you do share it on social media, don't forget to follow and tag me at Whose Body Is It. So until next time.